I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, deadly day. Israeli airstrikes target Hezbollah, leaving hundreds of people dead and forcing Lebanon into emergency meetings. How the White House is responding, plus analysis of the rising tension from Middle East expert Gershon Baskin. Plugged in. Pope Francis reminds the faithful of the true definition of power. And hats off to them. Why thousands of motorcyclists flock to a beloved Marian shrine in Portugal. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of Padre Pio. Our top story tonight, as Israel launches hundreds of airstrikes on Lebanon, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is putting civilians there on notice. It comes on the deadliest day of the conflict since 2006.
I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now.
The warnings have led thousands to flee southern Lebanon, causing panic and traffic jams. The onslaught of airstrikes has resulted in hundreds of deaths and thousands of injuries. The Israeli military says it hit around 800 targets while going after Hezbollah's weapons sites. In response to the devastation, Maronite Patriarch Cardinal Bechara Boutros Rey expressed profound sorrow over the attacks, calling them unprecedented and devoid of humanity. This comes as the Iranian president has accused Israel of seeking a wider war in the Middle East and laying traps to draw Iran into a wider conflict. Well, the Pentagon says it is sending more U.S. troops to the Middle East in response to the growing violence. This comes as President Joe Biden welcomes the president of the United Arab Emirates to the White House for talks. Topics include the ongoing war in the Mideast and the brutal fighting and famine in Sudan. Neither conflict shows signs of coming to an end. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, no word tonight specifically on how many additional U.S. forces are headed to the Middle East. That number is reportedly small, however. With 4 months to go in office, President Biden is dealing with several global conflicts, the Middle East, Ukraine, Sudan, and more. Whatever conflicts that don't get resolved soon will land on the desk of either a new President Trump or a new President Harris.
On the south lawn of the White House, President Joe Biden welcomes United Arab Emirates President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan for a bilateral meeting.
Sir, can you get a ceasefire done in the Middle East before your term is up?
With war raging in the Middle East and Sudan embroiled in a violent conflict facing famine, with fears that millions of people could die from hunger, the two leaders sit down to discuss the global crises.
I've been briefed on the latest developments in Israel and Lebanon. My team is in constant contact with their counterparts, and we're working to de-escalate in a way that allows people to return to their homes safely.
President Biden was asked just yesterday if he's worried about rising tensions in the Middle East.
Yes, I am, but we're going to do everything we can to keep a wider war from breaking out, and we're still pushing hard.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says Hezbollah has been supporting Hamas, so a ceasefire deal would help on both fronts.
Our message is, let us get to a cessation of hostilities in Gaza, and that will hopefully bring an end to all of this.
Meanwhile, this past weekend, President Biden invited world leaders to Delaware for a meeting of the Indo-Pacific group, the Quad.
We're democracies. We're democracies who know how to get things done.
And Monday afternoon, after meeting with the UAE's president, President Biden headed for New York for a high-level meeting of the UN General Assembly.
Now, the United Nations brings more than 140 world leaders to New York City, meeting for the first time since Hamas attacked Israel last October, almost a year ago. The leaders of Israel, the Palestinians, and Ukraine will all be there. Russian President Vladimir Putin will not be attending, but instead is sending Russia's foreign minister. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, for more, let's bring in former Middle East peace negotiator Gershon Baskin. Gershon, great to be with you as always. This accelerated cycle of violence between Hezbollah and Israel is prompting fears of an all-out regional war. Do you think that is where this is headed?
It could be. We're being led by crazy men right now in the whole region, it seems. that don't understand that what needs to happen is ending the war in Gaza to end the war between Israel and Hezbollah and de-escalate the region and move into a political process that will solve the problem of Lebanon and, of course, begin to put the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the track toward negotiations. But the first thing that needs to happen is ending the war in Gaza, because without that, Hezbollah is not going to stop shooting at Israel and Israel won't stop retaliating.
Gershon, is there anything at this point, do you think, that the U.S. can do to try and engage both parties and lower the temperature?
The key is in the hands of the United States. In fact, President Biden has to understand that he can use American leverage on Israel to get a deal done. Hamas has put a deal on the table. They've transferred it from me. I've sent it to the president. It's gone to the Qataris and the Egyptians and the Israelis. It is a deal that would end the war in 3 weeks. Israel would withdraw from Gaza. Hamas would release all the Israeli hostages, and there would be agreed upon release of a number of Palestinian prisoners. We would then move into a cycle of de-escalation in the north and dialogue between the Palestinian factions on figuring out who's going to control Gaza on the day after. Because everyone knows if Hamas stays in Gaza, there won't be a single dollar of money entering for rebuilding homes for 2 million people who are homeless today, with the humanitarian catastrophe there that has to be dealt with at an accelerated pace.
Over the weekend, Hezbollah's second-in-command declared a new chapter in the confrontations, which he called a battle without limits. Can Hezbollah sustain these strikes against Israel?
No, they can't. Israel can do to Beirut and to many cities in Lebanon what they've done to the entire Gaza Strip, and I don't think we want to see that. The people of Lebanon don't want Hezbollah to escalate this war. This is, again, as I said at the beginning, a war of crazy men who have lost control and are not thinking strategically or logically. And this is why it's so important that the United States and other allies, the French and other European parties, play a constructive role now in getting us to de-escalation while the Americans exert the extreme pressure that needs to be exerted on Israel to agree to a deal right now. The Qataris and the Egyptians need to pressure Hamas, and we can get this done. This war has to end in Gaza in order for the whole region to be safer.
In an interview, former IDF Defense Commander Brigadier General Zivka Haimovich voiced his skepticism about Israel's current military strategy against Hezbollah, saying, while impressive, it will not be enough to force Hezbollah's leader into a truce. What do you think about that statement? Do you agree?
100%. There are no military solutions here. These are political conflicts that have to be resolved politically. The military means that are being used to fight the battles will only increase the power of the extremists. It will not weaken the extremists. They get more powerful as more force is used, and this is something that the people in charge need to understand. They don't. They have military minds. They don't think strategically. They act tactically, and they make a lot of bad errors that kill a lot of innocent people.
Now, I want to ask you about Iran now. Do you see them directly intervening in this conflict?
For sure. Iran is playing its proxies in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq. And of course, Iran is a very big problem. But again, this has to be dealt with politically eventually. The supreme leader of Iran, Khamenei, is not going to be in power forever. The president who was elected seems to be a more moderate person who's been able to use his persuasion so that the Iranian response to the alleged Israeli attack against Ismail Haniyeh on Iranian soil has been pushed back, at least for the time being. And we need that kind of restraint in the region. I don't think the Iranian people support the Iranian regime. It's just a matter of time before there's changes there. But the more we escalate and the more we use military force, the more we can ensure that the extremists in Iran and in other places will stay in power.
Gershon, thank you so much for your time today and for your insights. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, now to the campaign trail, where the head of the Archdiocese of New York is weighing in on reports that Vice President Kamala Harris will not attend the Al Smith Dinner, a white tie event that raises money for Catholic charities that support needy children in the Archdiocese of New York. It would be the first time since 1984 that a presidential candidate has missed the annual charity dinner.
We were confident that she would find this. You know, she speaks very much about the high ideals and how it's good to get away from division and come together in unity and all. That's what the Al Smith Dinner is all about. We haven't given up yet. We're not used to this. We don't know how to handle it. This hasn't happened in 40 years.
Cardinal Timothy Dolan also says that Democrat lawmakers in New York are reaching out to the vice president's team to see if they can convince her to attend. The dinner typically brings together both candidates for president. And the dinner is named after Al Smith, a four-time governor of New York, who in 1928 became the first Catholic nominated by a major party to be president. Well, imagine betting on who's going to win the presidential election or a state Senate race. It could soon be legal. U.S. Appeals Court is reviewing whether it's going to allow a bet startup company, Kalshi, to take bets on elections. Several lawmakers are worried about election integrity. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with that story. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. Yes, Kalshi means everything in Arabic. And if you go to the betting website, you can literally bet on everything from wagering on the price of gas to whether it's going to rain in New York City this month to even if NASA is going to land on the moon before 2027. But now the company wants to bet on U.S. election outcomes. That decision is now in the hands of a federal appeals court after a lower court struck down the decision prohibiting the company from taking those bets. Lawmakers are concerned.
I don't think this has been a good trend in society where we just open up gambling and made available online. So I'm not particularly supportive of the fact that it ends up being the wild, wild west when it comes to elections as well.
With the explosion of legal online gambling, some things have remained off limits, like betting on the outcomes of U.S. elections. But betting on U.S. elections is widespread throughout European websites. Many of them currently give Vice President Kamala Harris a slight lead over former President Donald Trump. Congressional leaders tell me they don't want election betting legal here.
I'm definitely opposed to that because you could have forces that gamble on an election and then try to use money to make things go their way so they can win on the bet.
I'm not inclined to like gambling on those races, but, you know, people are gambling now on the craziest things. So I haven't really evaluated how harmful it is, but it doesn't sit well with me.
The independent agency which oversees legal gambling agrees. U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission issued a statement, quote, "An explosion in election gambling on U.S. futures exchanges will harm the public interest." But Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says she's not ready to rule it out.
I would say that is subject to our thorough debate and processing here, but in general, I do think that the online gambling industry does merit being looked at.
Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley isn't waiting. The Oregon senator has already introduced a bill to ban election gambling for all races from national to local. The appeals court decision is likely to come soon, but the issue will likely be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Tracy.
Well, Eric, I know you're also following the latest developments on funding the government, which is set to expire next Monday. What's the latest on that?
Well, Speaker Mike Johnson wants a floor vote this week on the temporary agreement that would keep the government funded until December 20th. But that bill still has to get through the Rules Committee tonight. And that's not even certain because several Republicans don't want another CR. They want true cuts in government spending. Now, this CR does not include any part of the SAVE Act, the election security proposal backed by former President Donald Trump, which would require everyone registering to vote to prove citizenship. Now, it would also include millions for the Secret Service in the wake of the assassination attempts against former President Donald Trump so the agency can hire and train more agents. Now, I did speak with Speaker Johnson about trying to convince Republicans on the Rules Committee to pass it.
Get this past the Rules Committee, sir?
Certainly hope so. That's the plan.
And why did you do it under
We try to follow regular process, regular order as much as possible, give everybody the opportunity to do their job.
So you're going to meet with these members on the Rules Committee, the Masseys and the Normans, and try to...
Of course. I'll do what I do every week around here and every day, and that's talk with all the members and build consensus and try to get the ball over the goal line.
As you heard, trying to get the ball over the goal line, he is meeting with some of those Republican congressmen and women right now. If it does pass the House Rules Committee, the measure is expected to have bipartisan support. Now, former President Donald Trump had previously called for lawmakers to shut down the government if the SAVE Act didn't get passed into law. Tracy, I'll continue to follow the latest developments on the CR.
All right. Thank you so much, Eric, for that report. And joining us now with more is Dr. Casey Burgett, Legislative Affairs Program Director at the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Dr. Berg, great to be with you today. The clock is ticking for lawmakers to reach a deal in Washington. What's the likelihood, do you think, that they will come to an agreement and avoid a shutdown?
Almost 100%. I really struggle to say 100% because, you know, everything can happen. But really, this has been written in the stars for a long time, despite having this more high-profile drama between former President Trump, members of the Republican House. But really, we all knew that this was going to be ultimately a continuing resolution after the election, and mostly going to be a completely clean continuing resolution, though there are going to be some additions added in, as the lead mentioned, with Secret Service and a few other items. But this will happen, and it will be done before the government shuts down, so all these members can go back home and campaign.
All right. Now, if it does happen, by any off chance, tell us what happens to the government and services that it provides, and also who's impacted by the most.
So if a government shutdown does happen, and this should be said, too, that they have to have contingency plans for an impending shutdown. So even if it doesn't run out of money, a lot of these agencies are making contingency plans by law or by process to what would happen to provide essential services. So folks who rely on the government, folks who visit national parks, any sort of entitlement that is not written within the actual program, a lot of benefits are affected here, to say nothing of just the uncertainty that it causes, not only with the broader economy, but within financial markets. It's just a mess that costs a lot of money to a lot of people, and it just simply doesn't need to happen.
Yeah, and as we heard from Erica, this version of the bill does not include the SAVE Act, a proposal former President Trump pushed for. How do you think that's going to play out for Johnson and House Republicans?
Not fun, right? I mean, this was always going to be his rock and hard place where he has to appeal to the former president, given his sway over the Republican Party, particularly for House Republicans. But he knew this was never going to pass the entire House, and it was going to be stymied in the Senate, let alone vetoed by a Democratic president. So this is why I said that this was all written before the play actually opened up its blinds and played out. We knew this was going to be a CR, but he had to do the political process to satisfy those in his membership, including the former president, to say, hey, we fought for this stuff, but we just simply didn't have the votes.
Yeah, we know there's a lot of deal-making always going on in Washington. Will the speaker need to lean on Democrats to get this passed?
Absolutely. This was going to have huge bipartisan majorities. That will be true, depending if they get through the Rules Committee, or they might even bring it up under what's called suspension of the rules, which is basically nerd talk to say, hey, this is non-controversial anymore. Let's just rack up the votes, and you'll see a huge amount of Democrat support there. Once it reaches the Democratic Senate, it will get a huge bipartisan majority there as well, and then President Biden will sign it almost immediately.
All right. Final thoughts on this.
Again, this was the process that we see out play out. We get the drama associated with it, but we all knew where this was going to end. Speaker Johnson did too, but he's just really fighting a lot of different parties, even within his own singular party. He has to make sure that he shows them that he's fighting for what they believe in, even if he knows it was never going to pass in the first place.
All right.
This is what frustrates people with politics, and I get it.
Yeah, and we're going to leave it right there. Dr. Berger, great to be with you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, now to the governor's race in the crucial battleground state of North Carolina, where several staffers have left the campaign of Republican hopeful Mark Robinson. The current lieutenant governor is accused of making disturbing social media posts more than a decade ago. Among those who left are a senior advisor, campaign manager, and finance director. Robinson, seeking to become the state's first black governor, denies writing the post and says that he will not be forced from the race by, quote, salacious tabloid lies. Officials in Birmingham, Alabama, are seeking information on a mass shooting that left 4 people dead and injured 17 others.
I think there are many things we can do. The first thing and the priority is to get these shooters, find these shooters and get them off our streets. That will require the assistance of community members, not just from last night, but anyone who will have any information related to the whereabouts of these shooters.
Police described the shooting as a targeted hit by multiple suspects. It took place over the weekend near a popular entertainment area. The police chief says a vehicle pulled up when multiple shooters got out of the car and began firing, then fled the scene. Authorities have announced a reward of up to $100,000 for information leading to arrests. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including signs of life. Pro-lifers take to the streets for an annual rally in Germany. And the people of Sri Lanka reject the old guard in electing a new president. Lanka picks a new president, Amara Kumara Dissanayake, while rejecting the old political guard. The Marxist lawmaker celebrated his victory with more than 5 million votes. This comes after the country seeks to recover from the worst economic crisis in its history, though there is some doubt this is the right path. Well, thousands of pro-lifers took to the streets this weekend for the annual March for Life in Germany. Attendees even paraded a handful of signs written in English. The annual rally aims to promote a culture of welcome for every unborn child. Organizers also presented a document which urges the German government to reconsider its current abortion laws and calls for a ban on assisted suicide. All right, now to Albania, where the prime minister says his country will create a sovereign state for a group of Muslims similar to the Vatican. The Bektashi order makes up around 10% of the Muslims in Albania. Originated centuries ago, they relocated after the foundation of the Turkish Republic. Albania's prime minister says that he is trying to follow the example of Mother Teresa, the Albanian Indian saint. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a match made in heaven, a pope and a president, how their friendship led to a lasting relationship between the U.S. and the Vatican. Are set to consider measures that would redefine marriage. Voters in California, Colorado, and Hawaii will weigh in on whether to remove the traditional definition of marriage as between one man and one woman. In 2020, Nevada became the first state to repeal its constitutional amendment, saying marriage is between a man and woman. Pope Francis reminds the faithful that true power is taking care of the weakest among us.
Il vero potere prendersi cura dei più deboli.
During his Sunday address at the Vatican, the Holy Father adds that truly great people always look out for those who need help and asks how many people suffer and die simply because of power struggles. And says even our Lord was rejected, but later was risen to new life, giving us a living and hopeful example. While diplomatic cooperation between the Vatican and the U.S. dates back centuries, formal relations were established relatively recently. And now the two are commemorating the relationship with a stamp of approval. EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief Andreas Tannhauser has more.
The Pope and the President. Two men, one purpose, promoting peace.
Here, in this holy place.
In 1984, they made it official by establishing formal diplomatic relations between the Vatican and the U.S. That same year, the Senate confirmed William A. Wilson as the first U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. The Vatican likewise named Archbishop Pio Laghi as the first apostolic nuncio to the U.S.
Put together, but she did it in a wonderful way, and you will.
But the relationship between the two states dates back centuries.
Indeed, from the founding of our republic, the United States has maintained consular relations with the papal states, and it wasn't until 1984 that formal diplomatic relations were officially established.
The U.S. and the Holy See continue to cooperate on many global issues, such as the protection of migrants and refugees, interreligious dialogue, protection of the environment, and conflict resolution. In particular, with regard to Ukraine.
That America.
Per lo stato della città del Vaticano, questa collaborazione.
For Vatican City State, this cooperation means being fully committed to defending the human dignity and rights of each person, protecting freedom, promoting justice, and defending the truth.
The U.S. echoed a similar sentiment.
La tutela dei diritti umani.
The protection of human rights, the promotion of social justice, and the protection of democratic processes, including in the United States, form the basis of this cooperative relationship, a relationship that is growing stronger all the time.
Sempre più forte.
To celebrate the 40th anniversary of formal relations, the Vatican created and unveiled together with the U.S. a commemorative postage stamp. The stamp shows the coat of arms of both states joined together by a ribbon featuring the papal colors of yellow and white and American red, white, and blue.
We wish to commemorate the history of our relationship with the Holy See, with the hope of strengthening and continually expanding our partnership.
In Rome, Andreas Tonhauser, EWTN News Nightly.
Finally tonight, hundreds of thousands of motorcyclists descended upon the shrine of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal, and they were not there to cause trouble. Instead, it's part of a blessing for their safety helmets. This year's ceremony was the largest ever, with an estimated crowd of 180,000 people taking part. The annual pilgrimage started with a parade, followed by a mass and a blessing. The rector of the Sanctuary of Fatima says many of the motorcyclists come to ask for God's protection through Our Lady for their trips. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.